State lawmakers are back in session, and Central Floridians could feel it. You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Sharon Stone. It's Thursday, January 15th, 2026. The legislative session is underway in Tallahassee, but today's show is more about what it really means for Central Floridians. The focus is on the conversations happening in our communities and how the decisions being made could shape daily life here.
All of our priorities are foundational. We know that when kids get a good, solid education, that they're much less likely to turn to crime.
Beyond dollars, arts matter to people. They inspire children, provide healing to veterans, and connect seniors to our community. When we fund the arts, we are funding healthier, stronger, and more resilient communities.
Before the session began, residents and organizations in several Central Florida counties had a chance to speak directly to their elected state officials about concerns and priorities. These are just a few of the voices from the 2026 Legislative Delegation meeting in Marion County.
I am here today to respectfully urge you to say no to mid-cycle redistricting.
Every month we distribute roughly 2,200 pounds of food to veterans and their families. With your continued support, we can scale this model to reach the 45,000 veterans in Marion County and thousands more in surrounding counties.
All threats to our natural beauty are not immediately visible. That's why Marion County is requesting your support in funding septic to sewer conversion programs, which are essential for protecting our water quality and safeguarding the long-term health of our environment while protecting our springs and waterways for all to enjoy.
Florida has proven to be a leader in dementia and care support. With our ever-aging population, we have to continue that momentum to fight the disease. So we have a number of proposals for the upcoming 2026 legislative agenda.
That 60-day session started on Tuesday. Let's hear from the people on the ground in Tallahassee who are following it day by day. We spoke to WUSF state government reporter Douglas Soule and senior writer for the News Service of Florida, Derek Cam, on Wednesday to get their take on the issues and what's standing out so far this session.
Well, what's standing out so far for me is the relationship or the deterioration in relationship between the GOP leadership. There's a very significant moment where the governor, prior to his stated state address, shook Senate President Ben Albritton's hand, but not House Speaker Daniel Perez's. And that became the most, I would say, talked about moment in the Capitol yesterday. Perez addressed it. He referred to it as petulant. Senate President Ben Albritton also was asked about it repeatedly in a press conference Tuesday afternoon. And he tried to, I guess, create peace between the parties, even though the House Speaker had some criticisms for the Senate side as well. Perez expressed frustrations with the Senate, said that there was lost opportunity because they weren't on the same page about things. You'll recall that last session was extended because the parties couldn't figure out what they wanted to do with the budget. So I think beyond just policy, the politics involved and the relationships involved are going to dictate a lot of this session and impact the policies therein.
Dara, I can't help but notice you had a bit of a reaction when Douglas described it as relationship.
I did, because that was kind of my notes. That's what I was going to lead with also. I think it's maybe contextualize it a little bit for your listeners. Why does this matter? You know, okay, we all know that politicians don't get along, and it's significant here in Florida because Republicans control everything. Governor DeSantis had major buy-in from the legislature during his first 6 years in office, and he is now entering his last legislative session, not counting if we have any special sessions. The fact that the House Speaker is calling the governor of his same party petulant, and that the governor is not shaking the House Speaker's hand before his traditional annual State of the State speech, it's not just reporter catnip. It is significant because it will affect their ability to get things done.
And we're hearing the governor may call a special session on property taxes. Douglas, I know you've done a lot of reporting on this. Can you help us understand what ideas are actually on the table?
Well, the House itself has created its own committee focused on the property tax specifically, and they're already pushing several measures forward aimed at reducing the amount Floridians would pay. Now, Governor DeSantis has been loudly calling for reductions for nearly a year now. He argues that when they decide to make a proposal and put it on the ballot, there should only be one proposal. So he's kind of against this House approach of pushing forward multiple things. For listeners, the important thing to point out here is no matter what the legislature passes, it's them, the voters, who have to decide whether it becomes the law of the land. And they need to do so by a 60% approval threshold on the 2026 November ballot. Even a couple of weeks ago, I thought property tax was going to be one of the bigger parts of this legislative session. But you had the governor last week saying that maybe it's going to be in a special session following the regular session. And the Senate leadership, the House leadership now is not stating definitively whether it's going to be solved by the end of the 60-day regular session.
There's been a lot of discussion about affordability, right? So both the leaders are talking about affordability as the most pressing issue facing Floridians. And they're kind of hanging their hats on this property tax thing as being the key affordability issue. But what they're focusing on is property taxes for homeowners. So the governor frequently will float ideas and says, Floridians, they should reap the benefits of these tax breaks that we're doing. Let the tourists pay. Let the Airbnbers pay.
And we don't have any set proposal from the Senate side. We don't have any set proposal for the governor, despite the fact that he's been one of the louder ones calling for this. On the House side, it's important to note, too, that the proposals are focused on Floridians with primary residences in Florida, but it wouldn't mean an utter elimination of what they pay. It's focused on non-school property taxes. They're being concerned about educational funding if they were to do a complete cut. Obviously, the final product is hugely unknown, but it'll definitely be, I would imagine, a part of the tug and pull between the negotiations between the chambers.
One of the sticking points on the property tax issue is that rural counties, the rural communities, and how their tax rolls are very dependent on homesteaded property taxes for revenue. So how do you kind of ensure that they don't lose all the funds that they need for schools and law enforcement and infrastructure by making significant changes to how property taxes are handled?
Some of the transportation bills jumped out at me. There was a bill to get rid of those registration decals on license plates and keep records electronic instead. And there's the hands-free driving bill that would make it illegal to hold your phone at all or even have it in your lap. Could we see changes to what drivers experience on the roads?
Handheld devices is one that has been around for a while, and I think that that could have legs. I'll tell you what. And I'm just a cynic, maybe, or I've been doing this for a very long time. I don't see that passing in an election year because it's kind of controversial. It's what we call up here a talker bill. I mean, for sure, it's a talker. The other one that I think has gotten a lot of traction, and I'm not really sure where this is coming from or why this is such a problem that needs to be fixed. It's the stickers that you put on your license, your car tag. The governor has come out in favor of this. The Miami-Dade County tax collector has issued maybe 5 press releases talking about what a great idea this is and how it's critical to save money and to benefit Florida drivers. The other thing that we are talking about here that could affect drivers is a bill that would require a state-issued identification card to say whether you're a citizen or not. So there would be, according to the bill that's filed in the House, it would say NC, as in non-citizen, on the back of your state-issued identification card, which is your driver's license, meaning that you're not a citizen. And I guess the reason for that is to make sure that anyone who's a non-citizen can't vote, which is already the case in Florida.
And just to wrap up, anything else on your radar that Central Floridians should keep an eye on this session? Start with you, Dara.
I thought that the education stuff is really interesting because that might have an impact on the way that a lot of people are using those vouchers. And I think the way that you're going to be getting them and the way that you're going to the accountability part of it, there's going to be deadlines, I believe. The Senate package has deadlines for when you can apply for the vouchers and when you can apply to renew them. I think also something for Central Floridians to watch, the My Safe Florida Home program that was very, very popular. I think you'll see the legislature throw more money at that program because people have been really scooping up those funds to try to help harden their homes against storms.
And Douglas, will you wrap us up?
What the legislature ultimately does with redistricting, with redrawing U.S. congressional map for Florida, will have nationwide implications. Governor Ron DeSantis has already called a special session in late April to redistrict, though there's some thought that maybe that could be done during the regular session. We don't know for sure. But regardless, whether it's done now and in the next 60 days or in late April, that's going to be a huge deal with huge legal implications. It's something we're going to be covering, not just when it happens, but for many, many months after, over the course of the political implications. Florida's congressional map already definitely disproportionately favors Republicans. We have 20 U.S. House reps who are Republicans and only 8 Democrats. Democrats are quite up in arms about this idea of changing the map and potentially giving even more seats to Republicans.
But I think all the stakes, the high stake nature of that redistricting could have an impact on deals that are being brokered during the regular legislative session. And something that I've learned in my almost 30 years of covering the legislature here in Tallahassee is that oftentimes the deals are not about directly what you're seeing going on. The horse trading isn't about the actual bill that's in front of you. It's about the many other issues that are completely unrelated to whatever that bill is about.
That was Douglas Soule, state government reporter at WUSF, Your Florida Team, and Dara Kam, senior reporter of the News Service of Florida and host of the Deeper Dive with Dara Kam podcast, covering the legislative session from Tallahassee. Every year, Florida lawmakers pass hundreds of bills. We asked Rollins College Assistant Political Science Professor Patrick Rickard if he sees any themes emerging in the issues lawmakers are prioritizing this session.
I think overall, this is a focus on, if I could be a little bit too broad, the individual of the state. There are concerns about cost of living, concerns about how our tax dollars are going to be used, concerns about AI, and they all really surround the push that politicians in Florida have had for making this a place that is good for consumers, good for the people that live there.
Stay with us. Later, Rickard tells us where he is seeing rare bipartisan agreement. As we continue to follow developments from the legislature, we want to hear from you. Tell us what issues matter most in your community. You can email us at engage@cfpublic.org or send us a talkback on the free Central Florida Public Media app. Your concerns could help us shape a future episode. You are listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media.
The Wrap is a podcast from Central Florida Public Media, curating the top Central Florida news stories and in-depth reporting each week. Join me, Brendan Byrne, as I bring you news headlines, deep reporting dives, and insightful conversations from the news team. A new episode of The Wrap every Friday morning. Get it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Sharon Stone. Ahead on the program, the Flutie Foundation created a concert series to highlight the talents of musicians on the autism spectrum and provide camaraderie for the performers and their families.
When we come together, like when we all gather in New York or gather in Boston or gather in Orlando, like it's like no time has passed and we just have a great time. And it's really such a great sense of community.
Coming up, we'll learn about the Stars of the Spectrum concert in Orlando. First, now that the Florida legislative session is underway, let's dive into some of the bills that could directly impact life in Central Florida, from doctor visits to schools and what your neighborhood looks like in the future. We're joined by Central Florida Public Media education reporter Danielle Pryor. environment reporter Molly Durig and health reporter Joe Mario Pedersen. Joe Mario, I'll start with you. There's talk about fetal personhood this session. Can you explain what does that actually mean in practice?
Yeah. So to put it very simply, it is the legal philosophy that designating human fetuses with the right to life and protections under the law. This is the third session in a row we've seen a version of this bill make its way around the legislation. What this bill would do is extend provisions of personal injury laws to unborn fetuses, allowing surviving family members to seek compensation as a result of negligence.
Can you give us an example of a situation that a patient or doctor might actually face?
I can. In 2024, the Texas Tribune reported an ex-husband sued his ex-wife's friends for helping her through an at-home abortion in a wrongful death lawsuit. The ex-husband sought $1 million from each of the ex-wife's friends, but dropped the suit in 2024. So similarly, if this were to become a law, and if a doctor carried out an abortion resulting in the termination of an unborn person, the family of the mother can seek bringing a civil suit against the doctor or the practice that carried out the abortion. Family members can include the father of the unborn child. It can also include the grandparents of the unborn child, too. It would not allow suits to be brought against medical personnel who are involved in assisting the reproductive process.
Listening to you describe it, I'm wondering what kind of questions are being brought up about the bill.
So the big question is how we define what an unborn person is. Last year, the bill defined an unborn person as a member of the species Homo sapiens at any stage of development. Some Republicans took issue with that definition, and they killed the bill because of that last year. The current bill uses the same definition. And the reason why that's an issue is fetal personhood could be used as a way of giving the same rights as the mother carrying the unborn person. And if that's the case, could those rights outweigh services or care that the mother may need in an emergency?
Okay. And I have to ask you, how does IVF fertility treatment fit into this whole conversation?
It's kind of tough to answer. Like I said earlier, this is the third time this bill has emerged during session. In 2024, a similar bill was drafted, but it died in the House on second reading shortly after a controversial ruling made by the Alabama Supreme Court, which declared that embryos created through in vitro fertilization should be considered children. That court ruled in favor of families seeking damages against an IVF clinic after a patient at the fertility clinic gained entry into a cryopreservation storage area, opened a sub-freezing temperature unit, grabbed embryos, burned themselves, dropped the embryos, and destroyed them. That led IVF providers to pause their services for fear of facing similar suits. As you can imagine, families did not respond well to that. Alabama lawmakers did craft protections for IVF clinics after that. With this bill in Florida, I mentioned that there were protections for medical providers assisting in reproductive services. It doesn't name IVF clinics specifically. It could include IVF clinics, but it's vague and it's still a cause of concern.
All right. Thank you, Joe Mario. Molly, I want to bring you into the conversation now.
Hi.
The Florida Constitution gives cities and counties something called home rule, so local governments have the power to handle their own issues without state approval. Senate Bill 840 was introduced this session by the same senator who sponsored last year's Senate Bill 180 to make changes to the law limiting local governments' ability to manage development and growth. Let's break this down. Why are local counties and cities pushing back so hard? You know, how is this law actually limiting local control in Central Florida?
Right. Yeah. Senate Bill 180 has been pretty much halting a lot of local planning efforts in their tracks. It blocks counties and cities in Florida from adopting the clause's more restrictive or burdensome planning measures at least until 2027 without defining exactly what that phrase, more restrictive or burdensome, means. It's been opening up local governments to legal challenges. And we saw this happen, for one example, in Orange County with Vision 2050, which was the county's kind of overhaul of growth regulations and their comprehensive plan. They had been working on that overhaul for tens of thousands of hours, they said. They spent 8 years working on it. And shortly after finally approving it, the state wrote a letter to Orange County saying that plan was null and void due to Senate Bill 180. Actually, the state took issue with a bunch of provisions, including several that weren't in themselves new, but were being framed maybe a bit differently in the overhaul of the comprehensive plan, but had existed for years. So the county has been working with the state since to try and revise the plan. And based on what I've heard from 1,000 Friends of Florida, that has been the route that they've been seeing a lot of local governments take, is sort of bending to the will of either the state, or sometimes developers have been bringing legal challenges. And it's been pushing local governments to make changes that they maybe otherwise wouldn't have made to their development regulations. At the same time, interestingly, Orange County is also part of a class action lawsuit challenging SB 180, and a group of more than two dozen Florida governments are attached to that lawsuit. 1,000 Friends of Florida is also suing in a lawsuit and co-filed by an Orange County resident who lives within the county's rural boundary, which is another thing that has been put under fire as a result of SB 180. And another big thing about the bill that's important to understand is that it applies retroactively. So it affects planning measures adopted as of August 1st, 2024. So in a nutshell, that is sort of what is creating issues for local counties and cities as a result of Senate Bill 180.
Okay, so help me understand, what changes are they trying to make this year?
Right. So as you noted, same senator who is attached to SB 180 has filed SB 840 this legislative session. Senator Nick DeSegli, a Republican representing Pinellas County. And SB 840 is an attempt to resolve some of the issues stemming from SB 180. It would reduce the range of local governments affected by the law. So right now, it's anywhere within 100 miles of a federal disaster zone, which is effectively every county in the state. SB 840 would take that down to within 50 miles of a federal disaster zone. It would also reduce the time that the law would be effective from 2027, as of now, down to June of this year. And it also is more specifically focused on regulations that would delay, like, hurricane-related repairs, which is really the impetus. SB 180 was originally intended to help local governments rebuild quickly after a disaster, right? After emergencies. But then many things were added onto it that go beyond that, that can be interpreted much more broadly. So SB 840 is more specifically focused on regulations that would delay hurricane-related repairs. So as opposed to a full stop, any regulations or policies that can be interpreted as more restrictive or burdensome than the status quo, SB 840 is more focused on hurricane-related regulations. So how people are feeling about it? 1,000 Friends of Florida is happy to see the bill, but says that it still does not right now fully address some of the issues with SB 180, specifically the retroactive nature of SB 180 and the limits placed on voter-approved planning decisions. So they say they're hoping to see the bill get even better during the session. As of Wednesday when we're talking, SB 840 had passed its first committee hearing unanimously, and it was waiting to be heard a second time.
Turning to Danielle now, one of the education issues that you're following involves undocumented students. What's being proposed here?
Absolutely. So this is not the first time that it's been proposed in the legislature, but SB 1052 in the Florida Senate and its companion in the House would ban undocumented students from attending public universities here in Florida. We covered a very similar bill that was filed by then Central Florida Republican Senator Randy Fine last year. It did not ultimately pass. But if this year's bill does pass, it would mandate, quote, a Florida college system institution or state university may admit as a student only an individual who is a citizen of the United States or who's lawfully present therein. It would bar anyone as well who's in the country illegally, including adults, from taking things like adult education classes at a public university or a public school district or even a state-funded community-based organization. So think English as a second language courses or GED classes. Students would not be enrolling in those either if this passes. The bill is coming on the heels of last year's repeal of in-state tuition for undocumented students in Florida. Governor Ron DeSantis has tended to support these measures because he says it takes away, quote, incentives to illegal immigration. But experts warn that taking away crucial education like this doesn't just hurt students and families, but also Florida's workforce. And now President Donald Trump has also followed suit. In April of 2025, we saw him issue an executive order directing the attorney general to take action against state laws that, quote, favored non-citizens over U.S. citizens. And we saw the DOJ sue a couple of states to block their in-state tuition policies for folks who don't have their papers.
Okay, so Danielle, if this passes, who feels the impact? Students, schools, families?
It's important to remember it's not just students and families that would feel the impact of this. Many already, you know, had to reconsider how they would pay for their college degrees last year when we saw the repeal of in-state tuition for undocumented people. But experts warn that making it harder for people who are going to be a crucial part of Florida's workforce makes workplaces more unsafe and makes workers less prepared to really tackle the challenges of this shifting job landscape that we see in 2026. It's also going to hurt Florida universities and colleges, especially the ones who tend to have a higher population of undocumented students and depend on those students to survive. We've already seen the impacts of Florida's immigration policies on Florida's K-12 schools. We've seen increased immigration enforcement has kept many families from sending their kids to school just this year. In Orange County Public Schools, for example, we've seen that they're down about 5,000 students this year compared to last, and they've cited immigration policies as one of the main reasons why. And then this under-enrollment led to a drop in revenue and budget shortfalls, and now they might have to close 7 schools. Brevard Public Schools is in the same boat. They might have to do the same. They're talking about closing a school as well. So the impact financially could be very detrimental to Florida's higher ed institutions if this bill does go into effect.
Before we all wrap up here, you three have very busy beats that you're covering. Is there anything coming up this session you're also keeping an eye on? Joe Mario, in addition to the fetal personhood that we talked about, what other health issues are on your radar?
So outside of that, you know, I'm really going to be taking a look at what's going on with Medicaid, what's going on with the Children's Health Insurance Program. We've been waiting for an expansion on children's health insurance for the last several years, and there are advocates that are going to be pushing for that here in the legislative session. So we'll be keeping our eyes on that, as well as, you know, I mentioned changes to Medicaid. There were some proposals to add more accessibility and more accountability to Medicaid, really reflecting some language that we've seen from the federal government about showing proof of employment to receive Medicaid benefits. So yeah, we'll be keeping our eyes on that.
Molly, what other environmental issues are you tracking?
Yeah, there are a bunch. One highlight is Senate Bill 354, or the Blue Ribbon Projects Bill. It's another one that has 1,000 Friends of Florida and other local home rule advocates pretty concerned. So this bill would define Blue Ribbon projects as developments of 10,000 acres or more, and it would require 60% of the land to be set aside as reserve and 40% to be eligible for development at up to 12 units per acre. So local governments would be able to approve these Blue Ribbon projects, these major developments, almost automatically through the administrative approval process, as opposed to going through the public hearing process to discuss and collect feedback from the public on future land use or zoning changes. So to kind of imagine what that might look like, 40% of 10,000 is 4,000. So under this bill, 4,000 acres of these Blue Ribbon projects could be developed at 12 units per acre. You're looking at up to 48,000 homes. So the city of Winter Park is about 30,000 people. And these developments, remember, could be approved without any public input. So regardless of how close they are to another urban area, et cetera. A little bit of context here. The state used to have a system in place for vetting and approving what was called developments of regional impact. These were major developments that would affect more than one county in Florida. That system was in place since the early 1970s to provide oversight and ensure that these developments were done responsibly. And that program was repealed in 2018. So there is no more system like that. As of Wednesday, when we're talking, Senate Bill 354 had passed its first committee 7-1.
And Danielle, are there other education bills that could affect families or schools in Central Florida?
Yes. So for the last couple of weeks, the governor has been traveling the state, drumming up support for an AI Bill of Rights. And a bill that would set up such a Bill of Rights has been filed by Central Florida Republican Senator Tom Leak. It's SB 482, and it would put protections in place for young people and even seniors interacting with AI. This bill was inspired in large part by the story of Megan Garcia's family, who lost their son to suicide. They are an Orlando family. He committed suicide after he had interacted with several AI chatbots over some time. I'm also following SB 318, which would reform Florida's universal voucher program and attempt to put a system of checks and balances in place after an audit last year found that money had been chronically misspent SB 430, which would require Florida teachers to pledge an oath to, quote, support, protect, and defend the Constitution and government of the United States and the Constitution and government of the state of Florida. And then finally, there are a number of bills we've seen a couple of years in a row that haven't passed, but maybe 2026 is their year. That includes a bill that would require kids to learn and show proficiency in cursive, a bill that would protect students from hair discrimination, and also a bill that would put safeguards in place for students with autism and other disabilities who run away from school. So I'm looking forward to following all these different bills that might impact Florida students and families this session.
Danielle Pryor, Molly Durg, and Joe Mario Pedersen, thank you all for being here and explaining how these bills can shape lives here.
Thanks for having me.
Happy to be here.
With so much division in politics right now, we want to find at least one area with bipartisan agreement. It may be around artificial intelligence. Governor DeSantis proposed an AI Bill of Rights for citizens that regulates AI data centers and how artificial intelligence can be used in Florida. The plan gives local governments power to block construction of large industrial centers that run the technology and keeps utility companies from passing operating costs onto residents. It also includes protections against explicit material and fake AI-generated images and videos, requires companies to tell people when they are talking to AI, and expands data privacy and parental controls. Republican State Senator Tom Leak of Ormond Beach filed a bill to bring the proposal to the floor. And Democrat Representative Christine Honchovsky from South Florida filed a companion bill in the State House. Assistant Professor of Political Science at Rollins College, Patrick Rickard, explains why AI is emerging as an area of bipartisan agreement and what he says may still be missing from the proposal.
There are a lot of questions about AI that could turn into a lot of different problems for people in Central Florida and in general. One that might be most of interest to a community would be the potential for AI to require data centers that use the same power grid that we use and require some of the same resources that we use. Florida hasn't become a hotbed for data centers yet, but in some cases in Florida, especially recently in Palm Beach, local residents have found themselves facing the cost of the construction of these data centers and the operation of these data centers, and that could cause utility rates to increase. Beyond that, though, there are also the general concerns that people have about AI, how it is being interacted with, and how it is using our data. Many people now use AI on a daily basis and may not realize that it is collecting the amount of information that it is collecting about them. And finally, there's the problem of what's somewhat known as AI psychosis. People who are interacting with chatbots who may not know or realize or understand that these are not humans and that they are not necessarily interacting with someone that they think that they are. The AI Bill of Rights and Governor DeSantis's proposals take aim at a lot of different elements of these concerns.
So that AI Bill of Rights that Governor DeSantis released last month, is that something that can be tackled on a state level versus national level? There seems to be some conflict with enforcement. What's realistic?
Florida has really led the charge the past couple of years in terms of internet safety for younger users. There's the recent bill that just took effect requiring people be age 15 or older to have social media accounts, and the requirements that producers of adult content have to verify the age of their usership. These are things that happen kind of just in Florida. The big controversy has come with President Trump's recent executive order aiming for a national policy framework for artificial intelligence, that we don't want to have many different standards across states that these AI companies have to navigate, but rather we should just have one national framework. DeSantis has said, basically, well, we're not going to sit to the side and wait for that national framework to happen. We are going to currently address some of the harms that we see coming right now. And I think he'll be able to successfully do that at the state level.
State Senator Tom Leak, Republican, out of Ormond Beach filed the bill bringing it to the floor, the AI Bill of Rights. So are you seeing consensus that AI requires regulation on the state level?
Absolutely. And a bipartisan consensus. While Leek's bill is really the center of the push to regulate AI at the state level, there are a lot of other bills that are aiming to do the same thing and aiming to bring some sense to the AI regulation discussion from both Republicans and Democrats. Even before Governor DeSantis was on board, last year, there was a nearly unanimous bill passed requiring the Department of Commerce to create a report for the possible effects of AI on the job market. This is something that is extremely popular across the state.
What is not being addressed in the AI Bill of Rights that has caught your attention?
So DeSantis has given kind of several speeches that have listed a broad framework of how he thinks that AI should be handled in the coming session. And while most of that has made it into Senator Leek's AI Bill of Rights bill, and some have made it into other bills, there are a few things that I really haven't seen yet. One of the elements of the AI Bill of Rights is listing the rights that Floridians have with regard to artificial intelligence, like the right to know if a political ad is produced by generative AI. And while these rights are listed in the bill, that doesn't come with accompanying protections. That is, if we acknowledge that Floridians have these rights, but don't put into place any punishment for a political campaign using generative AI duplicitously, then, well, that right isn't doing that much. The data center stuff comes in a separate bill from the AI Bill of Rights. That's not in that. That's in another bill by Representative Griffiths, and provides a framework for local control over AI data center construction, but doesn't necessarily go as far as some of the pushes that Governor DeSantis has made late last year for protecting taxpayers against utility rate increases or protecting natural resources.
So we've seen the role big tech played in getting President Trump elected and promoting tech-friendly policies at that federal level. Does the AI Bill of Rights run the risk of alienating this industry if DeSantis chooses to make a run at the White House in 2028?
It certainly does. Some policy institutes have said that this framework, this AI Bill of Rights, is basically saying Florida is closed for business with regard to artificial intelligence technology. I don't think Governor DeSantis would characterize it this way. In fact, some state legislators have said that the push for regulation in Florida is very different from the push in other states like California, which are focusing more on regulating what businesses can do, whereas Florida is focusing on defining what rights that our residents and citizens have. I think that is a spin that a lot of people will like. But of course, AI has benefited a lot from the lack of a regulatory framework around its development. And so they will probably be cautious about an AI skeptic like Governor DeSantis leading the charge.
Patrick Rickert is an assistant professor of political science at Rollins College. Coming up, meet a local artist featured in the nation's largest concert series by autistic artists, elevating voices in the autism community. You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. Be sure to subscribe to the Engage podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify so you don't miss an episode.
There's a lot going on in space, from efforts to land astronauts on the moon
and liftoff of Artemis 1
to answering the age-old question, are we alone in the universe?
Wouldn't you want to know if there was life on another planet?
Are We There Yet? Explores space exploration every Tuesday at 6:30 here on Central Florida Public Media.
You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Sharon Stone. the Hard Rock Live Orlando hosted a one-of-a-kind concert this past weekend. Engaged producer Richard Copeland stopped by the rehearsal last Friday.
It's noon on the nose on the second Friday of the year. VIP Studios is a recording facility in a semi-industrial complex in Winter Park. In the foyer, the muted sound of a band rehearsing floats from the rear of the building. Performers are rehearsing for a concert that is taking place in 24 hours at the Hard Rock Live Orlando. They are the lineup for the Stars of the Spectrum, a concert featuring performers on the autism spectrum, organized by the Doug Flutie Jr. Foundation for Autism, the nonprofit advancing advocacy for families with autism, named after the son of football legend Doug Flutie. Performers include pop singers Sierra June of Largo and Jen Masumba of Wachula. Brother and sister duo Jake and Sky hail from Pembroke Pines, and Orlando hip-hop artist MBS, and all of the performers identify on the spectrum. More importantly, they are all passionate about music. Jen Masumba is performing with Stars of the Spectrum for her fourth year. She plays guitar and sings songs that reflect her battles with autism and the victories she's experienced. Music has always been a part of Masumba's life.
When I was growing up, my mom would play these records by Carole King. And we used to watch this cartoon in school. They used to put the film on, and it was real called Really Rosie, and the music was done by Carole King. And I just would relax my whole self when they would play that. And I just love her songwriting and her music. Also, I like Bob Dylan. We have the same birthday, and I just like the way he tells stories in his music. And then more recently than that, the Indigo Girls is a band I grew up like listening to in the 90s. And their songwriting is amazing, and their harmonies. And I just love songs that have meaning to them.
A ghost of who you were, or was I wrong? Were you the monster all along? Old days, the VCR tape doesn't lie. You were for yourself, the smolder in your eye.
Stars of the Spectrum grew out of the COVID pandemic. The impact of the quarantines was recognized by the Flutie Foundation, who turned to YouTube to identify musicians with autism. Liz Monroe is the director of marketing with the Doug Flutie Jr. Foundation for Autism.
The autism community was very isolated. All of their programs were shut down. There weren't as many opportunities for them to see their peers. And we found actually a lot of autistic musicians online. So we hosted Facebook live streams where they performed live music, and the whole community just came together naturally. We are not a music foundation. We provide grants to people and families with autism to live life to the fullest and to autism-serving organizations. But because there was such a need and there was such a connection with music, we started Stars of the Spectrum thanks to the leadership of our amazing autistic ambassadors. And now we host concerts across the country called Stars of the Spectrum, where we elevate the voices and stories of people with autism.
Stars of the Spectrum facilitates that connection to music, as well as providing a connection to community, as Jen Masumba explains.
My mom says that I've matured a lot, that I am growing in ways. It's helping my confidence, not in like a cocky way, but in like that I can do things that are hard. I can collaborate with others. And I really like having my autistic friends because we just get each other. And as soon as we're around each other, we just all kind of get it.
22-year-old Miwosh Gazur is from Tampa. The pianist came to Orlando for the concert with his mother, Bochena. Miwosh is mostly nonverbal. He can answer brief questions about himself, but he cannot truly express himself to others. Bochena explains how she discovered her son's talent for piano.
Miwosh was diagnosed with moderate to severe autism at 2.5, and he was nonverbal. And then so we just tried to find something to interest him. And my older son was taking piano lessons when Miwosh was like about 7.5, and I was thinking, you know, I went to various conferences and I learned about, you know, what powerful music is. And so I just had this keyboard at home and I had these little booklets. I don't play the piano, but I used to play trumpet in a marching band. So I know how to read music. And I just took him to the keyboard and put his little finger on the middle C and went to, you know, C, D, E, F, G, A, and B. And it surprised him that by pressing the keys, he can produce the sound that the piano was making. And then that's how it began. So just little steps. And then by the time he finished his first book, we recorded a small recital. And then, although the music was like 50 seconds, you know, I looked at the video and it was like, wow, he's like paying attention to it. It was just so different from the child that, you know, we experienced with almost, again, no words at the time. Sometimes people ask me, you know, what is his favorite music? And it's because of his inability really to communicate. We don't know. I can only imagine. I think he loves the Phantom of the Opera. He plays all the pieces from the Phantom of the Opera. And then he likes energetic music. So he like loves Mozart. So I can only imagine that that's what he likes.
While Miłosz showed an amazing proclivity for the piano, the Gaziors encountered a problem that is all too common for parents seeking instruction for a child on the spectrum.
That was a difficult process. And when he was 9 years old, somebody told me the reason that was difficult because most piano teachers treated him like a special needs person. And so they didn't have expectations, really. But then somebody told me about this teacher who had a reputation of being demanding. And so I asked for a lesson and I didn't tell him that Miłosz has a neurological disability. So we went for a lesson and I was there the whole time supporting him. But the teacher told me, I had never had a student on the autism spectrum and I would not be able to teach him. I implored him, please give him 3 lessons with my support. And that after those 3 lessons, you still will think that you cannot teach him, I would understand. And this piano teacher still teaches him today, 14 years later.
Orlando native Maurice Shams is a hip-hop performer who also identifies on the spectrum.
They don't understand my brand, the way my mind works. I've been drowning in this pen to see the fireworks. I can never let the opinions up in my head. I can't give up about what they say. I'm just trying to stay up in my lane, yeah. I'm just trying to come up for the fame, yeah. Stay on the low tower, right these diamonds.
His stage name is MBS, his initials. The acronym has another meaning for Maurice.
Moving beyond struggles.
I asked him to talk about those struggles.
I get very like emotional dysregulated and I get stuck and I don't know how to function or what to do to calm down sometimes. I mean, it's like, you know, the same problems that I had when I was a kid. Like I used to lash out and like do a bunch of stuff and like destroy property and stuff like that. But now it's like, you know, I'm living in my own apartment and everything like that. Like, I'm doing a lot better, but I still struggle. Like, I'm not, you know, lashing out like I used to, but it comes in, like, other ways, like, where I just get, like, stuck.
When he's performing, whether on stage before a crowd or even by himself in studio, Maurice finds he can forget those struggles and just get lost in the music.
A lot of people are like, do you get nervous on stage? Like, before you go on stage, all this stuff, like, no, that's the one place I feel so, like, comfortable, and I've been doing it, like, you know, really since a kid, too. I don't know if that has anything to do with it, but it's just almost like a form of escapism, too. Like, I play video games and stuff like that, but when I'm, like, on the mic, like, even just recording in the studio or stuff like that, because a lot of my stuff is freestyle, like, just punching in and just what's on my mind, that's where I come, like, get my inspiration from is everything that I go through.
Jake is the brother in the Jake and Sky duo. The pair announced the release of their debut album earlier this month. Jake's appeared on America's Got Talent and played with Harry Connick Jr. back at the VIP studios. He's leading the rehearsal in preparation for the next day's concert.
I try not to speed up too much at those parts. I know, again, it's like exciting and it's fun, and it might be hard to stay a little bit slower at those parts, just trying to slow it down just a tiny bit. Again, it's sounding awesome, and we're definitely getting better and better. A beautiful mind. Be perfect. A uniquely wired brain. An amazing. interface with signals that cannot be taken.
And while the performers are focused on perfecting the show, it is the camaraderie and community they find in studio and on stage that brings them back year after year. Stars of the Spectrum isn't just a concert, it's a family. A family that is there for Bochena Gozier's son, Miłosz.
This means so much to me that he's included, because when he sits at the piano, he's not that different. Maybe the music is there, we just don't know how to break that barrier. But at this moment, it's just so important that he's included and can participate. And he's just so much looking forward to, you know, like going and being here. It's amazing to our whole family, really.
That's all for today's edition of Engage. Before we wrap up, a quick thank you to Amanda from Orlando, who wrote in with a thoughtful response to our recent conversation about rising healthcare costs. She wrote, "In 2026, we were shocked to discover the same plan would now cost $1,900, a monthly increase of $743. If we accepted the current coverage cost, we'd be paying 28.5% of our income for substandard health insurance we rarely use. We simply cannot afford it. It's almost as much as our mortgage, vehicle, and weekly food costs combined. Yet we make too much money to qualify for purchasing only catastrophic coverage. Therefore, we've decided to take the risk and go without health insurance this year and hope for the best while maintaining our healthy, active lifestyles." We really appreciate hearing from listeners, and we encourage you to keep sharing your experiences with us. I'm Sharon Stone. Thank you for the company. NPR News is next.